It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And yes, it's true. America's favorite soccer dad is back in the studio today and quite busy these days, to say the very least. But for now, we're busy doing what we're doing the way we want to do it, and only you can change that out there. Welcome aboard. If anybody out there is new, then try to hang on for the whole hour. Always learn something. That's one of the few promises we'll ever make anybody. But it's a lot of fun talking about money. Sometimes it's more fun than other times, and there's no lack of stuff to talk about today, to say the absolute least. So if you want to discuss one of the highlights of the day or just some questions that have been lingering in your mind or whatever, it's easy. Pick up the phone, dial 904-222-8255. Lines are open, and we will put you up on the screen immediately and talk about what you want to do. Otherwise, you're going to hear some things today that you don't hear every day from most people. And one of the nice things about being a live show is we can respond immediately to things that just happened. And there are some very current events this week to talk about. Unfortunately, the format of the show says that we have to talk about the market early in the show. And sometimes it would really be more fun to skip it, but it's probably even more important that we don't do that right now. So needless to say, not a good week, but not at all what some people are thinking, doing, and saying, and that's why you have to listen to the show today to find out what the truth behind all of this is. So take it away.
It wasn't just not a good week. It was also just a really strange week.
Yeah, it was.
So strange. I'm sure that there's someone in Jacksonville that had heard of Silicon Valley Bank prior to this week, but it wasn't me.
Nor I.
I had never heard of this outfit. It has now become the second largest bank failure on record. And that stat is a little bit misleading, as failures are measured in dollars but ignore inflation. So if you look at the largest on record, the first one was Washington Mutual, and that was in 2008. They had assets of about $307 billion. But if you look at the third largest, it was Continental Illinois National Bank and Trust in Chicago. And that was $40 billion, but that was in 1984 dollars. So that's much more than $40 billion today. I didn't do the math to figure out what it was. But some of these things are, you just really have to put it in perspective, because $209 billion today is not, if there had been a $200 billion failure back in the day, it would have been a much larger failure. So it's just interesting that they don't index those for inflation. It is a big failure, however. This was a fairly large outfit, not in terms of the big banks, but for a regional bank, it was quite large. Yeah. The thing that made it really interesting is that it failed in a very fast and very spectacular way. And I'm going to talk about it more in a minute, but I don't think I've ever seen a bank I've never heard of. And then I heard about it, and 2 days later, the Fed stepped in and took it over and declared it insolvent. That is pretty remarkable speed for something like that to happen.
It's pretty unique, I think.
Yeah, for sure. So the week started in a weird way when Fed Chairman Powell gave what I thought was a very bland testimony at his biannual congressional drilling. His comments were basically that if inflation persists, we will raise rates faster to deal with it.
All right, let's give him a big duh.
Yeah, that's what he said. That's what he's been saying. That is actually outlined in the mission of the Fed.
Yeah.
I don't understand why it was such a negative reaction. Was he supposed to say, no matter what, we are only going to do another quarter point hike and then stop? Or I don't know what their expectation was.
That's what people wanted.
But there was no change in his strategy.
No.
It was really, I thought, a very benign testimony. But instead, the market took a dive, and the odds for a 50 basis point rate hike at the March meeting spiked to higher than the odds for a 25 basis point rate hike. So really, really unusual interpretation. And then we got a sneak preview of the government jobs data when both the ADP report and the JOLTS report came in stronger than expected. not great news. The weekly jobless claims did come in higher than expected, so that actually was quote-unquote good news. Normally, the ADP report coming in higher than expected would be good news, but obviously when you're looking at a inflation data, that threw more fuel on the 50 basis point rate hike fire. Thursday, bank stocks started tanking suddenly, and it was kind of nothing that we expected or really anyone expected, but they really started tanking. And that's when we heard about the Silicon Valley bank starting, they lost 66% of its value that day. And by the time the shares were halted on Friday, it had dropped another 60% on top of that. Later on Friday, it was announced that the FDIC would step in and the state as well, and the bank was insolvent. And then just to pour more fuel on the fire, the government's jobs report came in, and it was way better than expected on a headline basis. And so now the market is pricing in a 68.3% chance of a 50 basis point rate hike in March.
What do you think?
I honestly don't think we need it right now.
I'll take you one further than that. If I had my power, if I had his power, I would defy the rules, and I would say, we're taking 6 months off to let the economy adjust to what we've already done.
I agree. I think that if you do a 50 basis point rate hike in March, which he hasn't really signaled that that's what's going to happen either. So I don't know. I just think it's a mistake. I think it would be, I think it's overkill. I think that they're taking short-term data and applying it to inflation, which is a long-term issue that is not going to unwind overnight.
Yeah, disinflation does not happen in 6 weeks between meetings. It takes a lot longer than that to wind things out of the system.
Yeah, and I think that if you continue with a 25 basis point rate hike cycle and things still aren't getting better in a few more months, then maybe you think about doing a 50 basis point rate hike, but I think it's premature, and I think it would be very damaging.
I can't disagree with a word of that. And as I've said often in the last few weeks, the problem with this inflationary cycle is that the Fed can't solve it because the Fed is not in charge of energy policy. Energy policy is the biggest driver in what's going on now because it affects everything you buy, and it is a solvable problem. And there is actually a proposal in Congress which hasn't been released yet.
It's like Biden is thinking about going along with it, I think.
It's close. So yeah. We're going to talk about H.R. 1 and a bunch of other things as soon as we get back from the break. We will, as usual, have a trivia question, so don't go anywhere. We'll pay some bills and be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we do have a trivia question, but we have a couple of public service announcements first. The really important one is a happy almost birthday, it's actually for tomorrow, to Adam's mother, my wife, my research department, etc.
Yeah, happy
just
birthday.
Happens to be the same person. But anyway, that's going to be a biggie, and we're looking to have some fun on that day too. And I know Adam missed last week because it wasn't here, but he wants to talk some more about the upcoming golf event for the charity.
I do, and I actually really hate missing, but occasionally it's just not and next weekend is going to be another one of those weekends, but then I promise I'm back and I don't have any more plans to miss. So just bear with me. We do have a great guest for you next week too. Yep. So anyways, I want to talk about the Joe 13 Golf Classic being held at Queens Harbor Yacht and Country Club on May 7th. Joe was a friend of ours, is the son of some dear friends of ours, one of my son's best friend's little brother, and he passed away from cancer 3 years ago now. They call it Joe 13 because last year was Joe 12, and he would have been 13 this year. Really, really sad. He had a very aggressive form of leukemia, but out of that comes something good. His mom and dad started a foundation, and they're actually a charitable foundation, so they are registered as a 501(c), And so all of the contributions are tax deductible, and all the money made by the foundation benefits the Mulligan Lab at St. Jude's Research Hospital. They research the exact type of leukemia that killed Joe, and it's just a great cause. They don't ever want anyone else to go through what they did, and that is their mission. They've given tens of thousands of dollars to this lab and hope to have their best year ever in terms of giving. So if you can, coming out on May 7th, register at joestrong.org. And play some golf with us at Queens Harbor. It's a really great event. It's sold out every year. It will sell out this year. So, and you have about another month to register at the early bird price.
Cool. And you have one better cause.
Definitely.
Okay. Trivia question brought to you as usual by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. And you can call Kenny at 904-636-7888. Now, talk about randomness in trivia questions. This one just hit me the other day, and I don't know why it got me, but it got me. So here it is. What is the current price for a lost tooth according to the Tooth Fairy today? The average payout. I remember when it went from a nickel to a dime, and I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I think, what did I get? Maybe a dollar, probably?
I think they were... Yeah, by the time you were born, I think it was. But what's the average payout for a tooth today from the Tooth Fairy?
All right, good question.
This is going to be pretty close to the penny. I'll give you 2 cents up or down.
All right, I wanted to give the backstory on Silicon Valley Bank just because it's in the news. It has a lot of people worried, and it's really a kind of a unique story anyway. I found it pretty interesting. The bank didn't actually go under from making bad loans, which is normally why banks go under. Being in Silicon Valley, you can imagine that a pretty high percentage of their customers worked for tech startups and venture capital groups. So as those people have gotten rich over the last 20, 30 years, they deposited a ton of money with Silicon Valley Bank, much of it over that $250,000 per account limit for FDIC insurance. But they felt good about it because the bank's been around. It's been a partner with them. A lot of them had taken loans for their company from the same bank. So it was a mutually beneficial relationship, and everything seemed to be good up until a few days ago. They had about $200 billion in deposits, and with that, the bank purchased $128 billion in interest-bearing bonds and treasuries that were supposed to be held to maturity. So when you hold a treasury to maturity, short-term fluctuations in price really don't matter because you're not selling it. So at the end, you're still going to get your full payout as long as whoever issued that debt is still solvent. And so if it's worth a little bit less in year five on a 10-year note, it really doesn't matter. But because they were supposed to be held to maturity, they also weren't what's called mark to market. And what that means is that if you are a company that has a balance sheet and you have an asset that is worth less than what you paid for it, in many cases under current accounting rules, you have to report that, and it makes your balance sheet assets go down. Well, they didn't have to do that because these were being held to maturity. So that in itself turned out to be a bit of a problem because the balance sheet looked stronger than what it actually was. And with the current economy, especially in Silicon Valley, there's a lot of people that maybe aren't as wealthy as they were a couple years ago. And so they started having less deposits coming in and more people taking money out. The problem was with the money coming out, they had to sell some of those bonds. And it turns out they had taken at the end of last year, a 17% loss on a lot of their portfolio. Ooh. Yeah. And so when that started happening, they marked those to market. Suddenly the balance sheet didn't look so good and more people wanted their money out. And it actually became somewhat of a run on the bank.
A feeding frenzy.
Yeah, and a rush to get your money out. So that was what drove the bank under.
All right. Good morning, Will.
Good morning.
Oh, hey, there, gotcha. What's happening with you today?
Okay, I have a growing concern. I work for an Uber Lyft company.
Okay.
And I'm concerned that I might be heavily invested in ESG funds, which are traditionally underperforming.
Yep.
I wondered if there's a way if I could find out if I am invested in ESG if there's a way I can shield myself against those inevitable losses because of my company's poor decisions.
Are you talking about the 401k plan?
Yes.
Okay. Then you should be able to get a list, probably quarterly, of what they're invested in. You'd probably have to go to your HR department and request it, and that has air quotes on it, which means demand.
I mean, they're required to give you a list. Is it a type of plan where you get to choose the assets in the plan, or do they choose them for you?
Currently, I'm letting them choose.
Do you have the option of choosing yourself?
I do.
Good. Okay. You know, if you could email me a list of the options that you could invest in, I'd be happy to take a look and let you know if any of them are extremely poor ESG funds. And the funny thing about ESG funds is that if you owned them prior to about 3 years ago, they actually were slightly outperforming because mm-hmm. oil was so negative for the longest time. And then over the last 3 years, what happened? It was the only last year, I believe, well, that and utilities were the only sure. two sectors of the S&P to make any money. So you severely underperformed the S&P if you held an ETF that excluded energy and oil producing companies. So it really is an important thing to look at today. And I'd be happy to take a look at it for you. You can just email it to us at info@vanweefinancial.com and let you know what I see if that's something that you're interested in.
I'm very interested in that because it's kind of a growing fear.
Yeah, get the available funds and get what your account is invested in. A year-end statement is probably the best you're going to do there. And send them both over and Adam will take a good look at it.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Did you want to take a shot at the trivia question? What's a tooth
I
worth?
I didn't hear the trivia question.
Okay, what is the average tooth worth according to the tooth fairy right now?
Are we talking about orthodontist, dentist, or the real tooth fairy?
The real tooth
the real
fairy.
One.
Oh, gosh, I'll say $5.
You know what? That's a pretty good guess, but it's low.
Okay.
My 5 and 10 cents.
Tell my grandchildren.
Adam's done it. Just be ready, people, when your kids get to that age, because you better start saving in advance. It's getting pricey out there. That's a sign of inflation, I guess. Well, thanks. We'll look forward to hearing from you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks. Speaking of great weekends, it's TPC week, so you know there's a lot of people in town who aren't familiar with the layout of things. Cut them a little slack because they bring in these gigantic American Express cards, and everybody benefits. So
yeah,
be good to them.
The traffic was notable yesterday, especially after all that rain and mm-hmm. everyone leaving Ponte Vedra at rush hour. It was a nightmare. But
you know how I know that there's a lot of out-of-town drivers here?
How's that?
People were using turn signals.
Although with the amount of out-of-town people that have moved to Jacksonville, I would say because of all the plates, but man, I see out-of-town plates all the time
now. All the time. It's amazing.
For sure. Just wrapping up Silicon Valley Bank, the uninsured deposits. So next week on Monday, if you had an FDIC-insured account with them, you're able to transfer that balance of less than $250,000 to another bank. So you're completely covered, and that begins next week. And that left about $160 billion of uninsured deposits at Silicon Valley Bank. Now, if you look at their assets, they can actually cover all of that with their assets. Now, the problem is how much of that was not marked to market. And then the rest of it is how much of those loans are going to be paid back. If they're high quality loans, most of that $160 billion will actually be recovered to the customers of the bank. So there's actually some pretty good news out of that. Even though they're insolvent, they might take a small haircut on their deposits, but it won't be a disaster in the terms of multi-billions of dollars that people lose. That's what's expected.
Agreed. Good morning, Marshall.
Gentlemen, my hope is this might be the one where they finally put the jerks in jail.
That would be fun.
You know, we have not put people in jail for doing this kind of stuff.
That's absolutely true.
Can I hold over through the break? I got some questions for you.
Yeah, that sounds good, Marshall.
That is an excellent idea. And
before I forget, these guys never paid attention to Philadelphia National Bank that did the exact same thing with bonds.
Interesting.
Well, we will look forward to picking this up on the other side, so don't go anywhere.
The real tough part about that is that they did invest in bonds and treasuries, which are normally considered very safe assets, and they normally are very safe assets, and it really came back to bite them.
Yeah, when we, after the break, there's some lessons for people to learn here, and you're going to hear some things that will change your life a little bit if you didn't know them already. But basically, these people were not running it well. So
no.
With that, we'll be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we're going to get right to Marshall, who has a corollary story. But I did want to mention that the SVB Bank was not the only failure this week. There was another one a couple days before. It was called the Crypto Silvergate Bank. And I just feel like I don't even have to dignify talking about that one.
Yeah, that one surprises me much less. The Silicon Valley Bank, I honestly don't think you need to send them to jail because
I don't think they had any
ill intent. It was a matter of some unusual circumstances. Now, could they have managed it better? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I don't think it was a willful negligence situation. I think that they thought they were doing the right thing, and it came, and then no one really expected treasuries to fall, especially long treasuries to fall as much as they did last year, until we were about halfway through the year, and then it all made sense. But at the beginning of the year, no one was thinking they'd be down as much as they were.
The CEO sold like $2.7 million worth of stock on the 28th of February, and That is going to cost it.
That's
jailable to me.
For sure.
The failure itself shows a lot of negligence in structuring the entire financial structure of the bank using only the longer bonds. They should have had more liquidity built in by having the shorter bonds, which would not change in value as much. But also, they didn't do a big enough percentage of their loans as floating rate loans. So
would have helped, yeah.
Yeah, they're lending at a fixed 2, and as borrowing costs go up to 3 and 4, they were eating the spread that normally keeps them alive.
Well, we'd been addicted to zero interest rates for 10 years.
But, the one thing that's guaranteed in life is change, and the directors should have gotten together on that. But I'm going to talk to somebody who knows a lot more about banking than I do. And that would be Marshall.
No, I've just seen how many mistakes people have made. And my question for y'all, Philadelphia National Bank, with either the 70s or 80s, really put a high percentage of their portfolio into long-term bonds when it was expected that bonds were at a good yield. And it was much more so than anybody else had done. And, you know, Tucker Carlson's show last night, I think, should be required listening for anyone who wants to know what happened here and what the overall impact is happening today when we're not having the brightest guys running the show. He was using examples of the things that bank was promoting, and Mr. Kramer has been touting them for quite some time.
He did a month ago on his show.
And that alone would have made me sell it if I owned it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it concerns me a bit because I grasp the concept of the exchange-traded funds and their value, but I'm wondering how many banking exchange-traded funds had SVB and Silvergate?
That's probably something that we will be able to uncover.
Well,
this is all a little too new right now.
I would guess that it depends on the fund, but if you own a banking sector or financial sector fund, it owned it. But that's the beauty of a fund, is that it owned it, but it's going to be in a percentage it's a small regional bank and a crypto bank. A crypto bank might not be owned, but the regional bank would have been owned, but it would have been in a percentage commensurate with their market cap, which is very, very small. So Yeah, it would affect that fund, but it wasn't the reason that you saw the financial sector funds drop 8% on Thursday. That was because people were selling off every financial asset in that exists.
Well, but my point is with the exchange-traded fund, are that how heavily are they individually weighting and researching the banks that they're putting in there?
Well, they don't actually research them.
Nope.
Mutual funds would. Yeah, well, active mutual funds would, right. but
not the ones that track the sector.
Yeah, so if you are buying a sector fund, they buy the whole sector. That's the whole point, is that you're diversifying within all the different banks in that sector. So if one fails, it doesn't hurt you so bad. Like if, for instance, if you bought three banks that you really liked and one of them went out of business, you'd lose 30% of your money. But if you bought the with that whole pie, if you buy one financial sector fund, that one bank represents less than probably 2% of your entire portfolio.
Yeah, we always go for volume of ownership.
Is this methodology of ownership giving some wackos a little bit more free rein in their carrying out of their business? And the reason why I say this, I mean, I grew up in this, Steve and I are the same age. My dad read Value Line every night. He taught me how to read and understand what does this business do? Where did the management come from? How did they generate their business? What are their successes? I mean, we didn't have much, but when we bought something, it was because we had studied it diligently.
Well,
have we gotten away from that thought process with the ETFs?
There is some of that with ETFs, definitely. On the other hand, the good news there, the diversification does prevent you from getting killed. That's the whole reason you diversify.
Okay.
You give up the opportunity to make a killing, but in return for that, you don't get killed. And that's the whole philosophy of the mutual fund and ETF industry. But let's go back to the banking sector. That's one of the most highly regulated sectors around. Where are the bank regulators?
Yeah.
That's what I want to know.
What I would say is you have to understand the bank regulators are the least educated in the industry.
I mean, that seems like a government failure. I absolutely believe that.
Well, but think of what we're talking about. Who is the Secretary of Treasury? Who is the Chairman of the Fed? These are people that are so divorced from reality. You know, the Secretary of the Treasury is over there trying to hold up the pension funds in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When she's got banks having problems in this country.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess my point is just thinking out loud with you guys, is the ETF, I mean, I worked for Wells during a period of time when I thought they were a wonderful company. They did a great job. They were very good to me. But I saw this creeping in of so much risk management, so much we're going to promote certain social programs and getting away from what had been successful in serving the customer. That has to be an indication of where risk is coming in versus those who are sticking to what they're good at and saying, we can do this. And the ETF is protecting them, those that can't. So,
I could make that argument either way, Marshall. I think it's a good point. But at the same time, there's still a lot of investors out there who like to buy individual securities and like doing the research, or don't and just throw darts at a board and buy stocks because they heard something good that Cramer said. So I don't think that the ETF has changed the ratio of people that want to research those stocks. I think that it has allowed people who have no interest in doing research and don't even know how to do it to buy into stocks in a much safer way than they would if they were to just say, oh, Silicon Valley Bank, that's tech stocks are hot. That sounds like a good play. I'm going to buy that.
Yeah.
Yep. So
all true.
you kind of make that argument either way, and I don't know the right answer, but it's a good point.
File that under the category of, well, either no good deed goes unpunished, for one, or that...
Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Okay,
I appreciate it.
Did you want to take a shot at the trivia?
Yeah, I'll let somebody else make a buck.
Okay,
thanks, Marshall.
See ya.
Have a good day.
Yeah, that's a great discussion, and I've been doing some research on it. It's not ready for primetime radio yet, but about the definition of diversification and how many things do you have to own to truly be diversified. There have been a couple new studies out that are really kicking the daylights out of the old studies, and when it's ready, you'll hear all about it. It's very interesting, and you know, like Marshall says, you got to do research, but most of us, we don't have time to research everything that we would possibly want to own. We have to do a much broader look at the economy and the asset classes and so on to make a good portfolio. So, I don't know. You've got the choice out there. You can be a stock picker. You can own nothing but mutual funds that are active. You can own ETFs that are inactive. Now they want ETFs that are active, which that one scares me. But there are many, many ways.
I don't know why that scares you. It's no different than a mutual fund that's active.
Because I think it's going to ruin the whole concept of what an ETF is for.
Well, I don't think so. There are mutual funds that are just index funds, and that's they're actively too. Managed mutual funds. Why can't there be both in ETFs?
Well, I, for one, will be late to the party when it happens.
Okay. Happened. They exist.
Well, it exists. Well, you could talk about these things all day long, and we can only talk about it for another 15 minutes. And that comes in right after the break. We've got a few things more to wrap up here, and then I'm going to start a long series of my personal top 10 rules for everybody to follow financially, which was at the special request of Angela Walker when we did our mutual shows together last week. So I promised her I'd start today, and it's going to be the countdown starting with number 10 after the break. So we'll pay some bills, be right back, and talk about all kinds of fun things. Don't go away. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And without any fuss and muss, we're going to go back to the telephones. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen.
What's happening?
Well, I was listening the other night to another financial show who brought up comments by Arthur Laffer. And we know Arthur Laffer, of course, from the Laffer Curve. Yes.
The most famous napkin ever in the world of finance.
Yes. And very interesting man. And I agree with him a lot of times. But as he was talking, I agree with him about if we had less taxes and didn't put the burden on the people of the country, that we'd generate much more economic activity. But he also said that trade deficits, like with China, aren't necessarily bad. And just wanted to get your viewpoint. His point was that because interest rates are higher now, that the Chinese buying up our debt is a good thing. And I understand that the Chinese have quite a bit of our debt. And two questions. If they called it in, would that be good for us? And being that they're definitely an adversary, does the Chinese having such a trade surplus with us, is that a good thing?
I can't make that argument.
So I know what the argument is, and there are times in history where it did make a lot of sense. Today, maybe less so. But the argument is that if it's an allocation of resources argument, and it says that if the Chinese are the best at making things and they make them the cheapest, and it gives the U.S. consumer a 20-30% discount by making things in China and shipping them over, then that is the best use of those resources. Well, the U.S. is better at, say, designing iPhones. That should be done here. And therefore, it frees us up to do what we're good at and them to do what they're good at. And that's the reason for the trade deficit. And so that I believe is most people's argument as to why that's okay.
Yeah, that is a good and valid argument, but I have a couple bones to pick with it. And to me, when you send more American dollars to China and we have this deficit in the trade balance or the imbalance of trade, then what's China doing with it? Two things. They're buying gold and they're buying America. Mm-hmm. They already own food companies, lots and lots of farmland and that kind of thing. And that, in my humble opinion, as long as they're our stated enemy, that has to stop. And the best way to stop it is to eliminate the trade imbalance, because then they won't have our money.
Right. So 20 years ago when I was in grad school, that was the argument. And a lot of the things that are true today were not either known or true back then. And that made a lot of sense to me. Today, I probably would go the other way and say that maybe we need to do something about that.
Yeah, the attitudes have changed there and here. And it all started when we let them into the World Trade Organization. And it was a well-intentioned but poorly planned move on our part. But then again, consider the source, who was president that did it. Yeah, there you go.
I agree entirely. Very quick shot at the tooth
sure.
fairy.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to say $6.22.
Somebody's been doing some research. And that is exactly right. Well, it's within my 2 cents. 623 is the number I came up with. So if we had to go back to our childhood and demand $6.23, a tooth fairy would be a figment of your imagination by now.
Pretty well, sure that's over six times higher than what the tooth fairy brought me.
Pretty much.
That's great. I had a friend on the Lower East Side. He lived on Cherry Street. His name was George Washington, and he could never tell a lie. Cherry Street now, one of the housing projects I worked, Rutgers Houses, is built where he had his nice home. And I cannot tell a lie. I saw this on Google. So,
amazing. What can you say?
Yep. Well, good job.
Yeah. All right. We're going to put you on hold and get your address and such, which we probably have, but I don't want to take any chances. So thanks for
thank
the call.
Thank you, gentlemen. I always love your show. So many others do also. Have a great weekend.
We thanks, appreciate Mike. Hearing that. All right. This one's for Angela. A lot of you have known me a long time, and you know that
there's
another one on the call.
Yep.
We always say, you know, callers first.
You know the rules.
Good morning. Donald, is it?
Ronald.
Ronald, okay. I'm missing the first letter, so I've got Arnold.
Okay. I bought a call option a couple of weeks ago, uh-huh. And, you know, it's gone down since then. And according to my brokerage website, one of the things I can do is roll it over. To a later date, I guess. My question, I'm assuming that what that means is they sell my first option and they buy a new one. Is that right?
Yeah, there's two kinds of those transactions. There's the sell to close and the sell to, what's the other one called, Adam?
Open.
To open. So, yeah, it would basically be a swap.
My question is, how does that affect the deductibility of the first sale, since it'll be a loss and it's and buying a new one less than 30 days later?
You know, that is a CPA question, and I'm a CFP, and I am not going to stick my neck out on this one just for the simple reason that I don't know. And I don't mess with taxes. If I don't know something, then I refer you to someone who does.
Yeah, I don't want to tell you the wrong thing. I mean, it sounds like if you sold the one at a loss and bought another one, that it would
on
generate
the same issue. To me, that would be a wash sale. But
well,
I was
thinking that it would be considered a different security, and then that
because it's a different
date
option.
That's out of my realm. We're not allowed to trade options, so I'm not really up to date on it.
Because I don't think they would publicize that if you get doesn't help you out at all, you know.
Yeah. If anyone listening knows the answer to this question, please call in, because I just don't do enough options trading to know the answer to that question. But I'd love to learn it. So
I did a lot of it in the 90s, but I wasn't ever swapping them out. It was either a go or a no-go on all of mine. Yeah. So
thank you, guys.
Well, yeah, sorry I couldn't help more, but we'll hope to hear from somebody who knows the exact answer.
Yeah, and good luck with the trade.
I'll be listening.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right. Angela and I were talking last week. As I mentioned, I did her show with her, and she did our show with me. And I mentioned in passing during the show that I carried around a top 10 list, which I always do. It has evolved a little over my 21 years in the business, but it's amazing, 22 years now that I think of it. Anyway, it's amazing to me how little it's changed, but some of it's up to date. So I told her I'll start a series, the countdown, and it just happens that we timed this not on purpose, but number 10 says diversify your investments. And that discussion has just taken place in the last few minutes. And the way I always look at it is think about Enron, which was the biggest event that happened while I was in practicing, when it just sort of went totally under. And Ken Lay had been, when touting it to all of his people, put every penny you've got in Enron stock. It's a sure thing, on and on and on. And then one day, it was gone, just into thin air. It went from something to nothing. And strangely enough, along the way, I met a lady who had in her stack of stuff that her husband had saved up on for many, many years. She had one share of Enron stock. And when I saw it, of course, this was years after the bankruptcy, I asked her if I might borrow it from her and put it in a frame. Because in our office, when people come in and we start talking about diversification, I'll occasionally pull that thing out and set it in front of them. And no one has to say a word. You look at a stock certificate for Enron, and you know exactly that it's worthless. So this nice lady who was a client, unfortunately passed away. She said, "You can put a frame on that?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd like to." She said, "Then you can have it, because all of a sudden it'll increase the value of the certificate to whatever you pay for the frame." She has a very good understanding of that. So if you are a one trick pony, so to speak, if you have all of your money in, say, a single issue stock or a couple of them, or if you are the real estate type, we meet these all the time. I'm only in real estate and I'm going to make a killing off of that and so on. Well, that doesn't always work out either. And now you've got a bunch of people speculating in crypto where they don't really have the money. The lesson here is there are seven main classes of assets: cash and equivalents, domestic stocks, domestic bonds, foreign stocks, foreign bonds, real estate, and hedges. Hedges are things like commodities. A good portfolio, meaning a diversified portfolio, should have more than one or two of those seven asset classes represented in the portfolio. Personally, I think if you don't have four of those represented, you're probably under-diversified, which is okay if you're just starting out and you're young and you just have a little bit of money. Then I say the domestic stock market is the place to be if you're young and you can take that risk. But as you get older and your balance gets higher, you gradually have to add in different asset classes in order to be successful long term. So number 10 is diversify your investments. Number 9 for next week, since we're running a little short on time, says insure yourself and your family before it's too late. And the bottom line on insurance, two things. You don't ever want to use it, especially life insurance. It would be terrible to use it. And the day you need it, except for Obamacare, you can't buy it. Obamacare, maybe I can get